But yeah, it's actually a good segue for today's lecture on Neri Oxman's work, related to weight. Like the Buckminster Fuller came up last couple weeks, and he used to have this question he would always ask like students and other architects was, how much does your building weigh? Because it was a matter of, he was trying to switch the industry over from buildings that were based on compression to buildings that were based in tension. And so compression's all about weight. And so today's lecture with Neri, she's kind of following Bucky's direction of lighter buildings and dealing with tensiles.
I
got these off the internet this morning, like about an hour and a half ago. There's a couple videos of it that are circulating.
Did they know what caused it?
Yeah, they were trying to lift too much weight. They were lifting 16 tons of concrete. And it overheated the lift and caught fire. And then the fire burned the cable that was holding the crane up.
Was there anybody up there?
The operator was up there. He was able to, once the fire got out of control and he couldn't put it out, he got down. And there was only, so far there's only six injuries, no fatalities. So they got pretty lucky. A couple of them were firemen.
Really?
Some of them were construction workers. I think there was a couple.
Crane operator was sued in a few years ago for deaths of workers.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, there was a couple, just not too long ago, there was another crane that dropped in New York. It seems like it was within a year ago, maybe.
But they should have known that was too heavy, shouldn't they? I mean,
yeah, he was obviously probably doing something he shouldn't have been doing, would be my guess. Right. Well, it also, from what I understand, it wasn't an active job site. So I'm not too sure whether they were just starting back up, you know, and they were lifting material up or what was going on. But like I was saying earlier, so this was segues perfectly into today's lecture with Neri Oxman. There was some comments made earlier about Buck Fuller, and he was trying to switch the industry over to tensile buildings from compression and dealing with weight. And so he was interested in making buildings that were lighter. And so he would always ask his students and architects, how much does your building weigh? I'm trying to make the point that we're, you know, using too much material and too much weight. And Neri goes in a similar direction today that we're gonna see here. She's in my mind, she's the most visionary architect that's practicing today, which is kind of low-hanging fruit. She's possibly one of the most brilliant minds in design in general.
Does that mean she teaches here?
She teaches at MIT.
Oh, because it says science.
Where did she study
architecture? So I'll get into that here. She studied architecture in London at the same school that Zaha Hadid, the Architectural Association, if you recall back a couple weeks ago. But then she also got a doctorate at MIT, and then after that continued on to teach there in the media lab. But before we get into that, I wanted to show... speak just a little bit here in contrast. If you recall back from a couple weeks ago, we talked about Museum of Modern Art with Philip Johnson, who was the curator there, put on some exhibitions of architectural work. The director that followed Johnson, Arthur Drexler, taught or mounted a show in 1972 where he labeled the five architects. And this was the five architects, in his opinion, of the time: Peter Eisenman, Michael Graves, Charles Guathmey, John Hayduck, and Richard Meyer. And these guys were referred to as the New York Five, or more loosely the Whites, and they were referred to as the Whites because their architecture was kind of following in this Corbusier, if you recall back to Villa Savoy, this white structure. Meyer was probably the most, took it to the most degree, where his building was completely pristine white, and it's reflected here even in his ink on vellum drawings, where he's trying to make that real crisp contrast, in contrast in particular to the natural setting, to where the architecture is not blending into the natural setting, it's in stark contrast to it. We see in his work, again, these five architects were trying to hold on to this modernist tradition of Mies and Korb. We see the ribbon window here as you enter into this. This is the Douglas House, the rooftop garden. Again, one of Corbusier's traits. But in particular, I bring this up because the house, despite the fact that he's, again, also the play of the glass wall here, the glass box, looking at Mies's Farnsworth house, but then also just the articulation of it with the mullions and the window units. But the house was constructed mostly of wood and painted. And wood is, as someone mentioned last week, is a fibrous organic material. And so it's porous. And so it's painted to protect it and have it hold up. But nevertheless, over time, it requires this continuous maintenance to keep it kind of in this pristine form that he's trying to create. Some of the jokes about Meyer is that his work never looks as good as it does the first day that it's completed. And so there was an article just recently written in the Architectural Record where they said that the problem with crisp, white, pristine houses is that their impact depends on remaining crisp, white, and pristine. Meyer's buildings age like any other, subject to time, weather, and gravity. Aging, however, does not suit them as it might, say, a Richardsonian masonry structure, enhanced by the patina of time. And so this speaks to what we get in here with Neri's work, where she's trying to embrace this natural weathering that you get of the architectural material. She's saying, maybe we shouldn't be working with these materials that we have to constantly maintain and have to constantly try to hold up and upkeep against this onslaught from the elements. Maybe we should work with the elements in the materials that we're using. In fact, quite a few architects have little understanding of the material sciences and the assemblies, the durabilities, and as a result, much like this Douglas house, the average lifespan for an American house is about 34 years, which again requires continuous maintenance, repairs, replacement. If not for physical deterioration, but also psychological, to where you have this kind of churning or this propensity for change or fashion, keeping up with the Joneses. And so you have, a lot of times you'll have materials that are changed out even before they've even reached kind of their limit of their physical use. and this speaks to this idea of carbon neutral. The Institute, the American Institute of Architects, has this LEED standard where they're trying to create these green buildings. In addition to that, over in Europe, they have what's referred to as the Passive House standard, which is even more restrictive than LEED. And they're all trying to get to this point of like carbon neutrality, to try to reduce the amount of material and energy that's used to create these buildings. Again, to try to head off this global climate change that we have. And then here, I brought up a tweet that Neri just posted here back not too long ago here in July, where she was making the point that nothing truly is truly carbon neutral. And so even though this is kind of our standard or goal that we're trying to get to, in reality, the physical sciences don't even allow you to kind of get there. So it's kind of a losing battle. to that point, another strategy is this idea of adaptive reuse. And with adaptive reuse, it's the concept of when you have an existing building that you no longer need or use, but you have a new use for, you could try to use the existing structure and thereby having to tear down or replace or rebuild less again, to try to use less material, less energy. Here's an example of this hotel in Switzerland called the Noel Stern Hotel. And this is a hotel that was built in a nuclear bunker. So this is taking advantage of something that theoretically is no longer needed and converting it to a hotel. This in this again, this adaptive reuse concept. Right. Interestingly enough, just recently, this past in 2020, a couple years ago now actually, with the whole COVID lockdown in April of 2020, it was an interesting study on this whole carbon neutral concept because for that month when businesses shut down, people stayed kind of locked down at home. There was less traffic on the road, there was less business and commerce, and they measured actually a carbon emissions dropped 17% in that month. And so it's this even this thought of even if we came to a full stop and we just stopped construction completely and reduced, again, the use of this energy and material, this is a way to kind of reduce our emissions, but it still might be impossible to kind of get to zero. Again, this idea of a net zero carbon building. The same hotel company here came out with now another hotel where they just put it out in the open. The idea of, again, kind of eliminating the architecture completely. So that way, again, kind of get this zero footprint. Going back to MoMA, there was an exhibit that I believe is still going on. This artist that does these visual installations. And it's interesting how even art has now become a medium in our kind of our virtual age to where it's no longer static. What we think of as art in museums as being a painting on the wall or a piece of sculpture sitting on the floor has now become these kind of video type installations. And to where now architects are picking up even on that with trying to imagine what if our architecture also was not static? What types of means and methods and materials do we have today to where we could get an architecture that is able to move much the same way that we see this art kind of taking on this method? This is some renderings. Again, we talked about this a couple times already. This is Midjourney, which is an AI software creating some visual renderings of architecture, morphing them in a active way. And so this kind of speaks directly to what Neri is trying to do with her work. She's trying to find a way to create an architecture that is living, much the same way that Frank Lloyd Wright was trying to create a living architecture, Antonio Gaudi. All of these architects through history have been trying to create an architecture that's living, but in their mind it was more kind of a metaphysical living where the space comes alive. She's literally trying to make the building alive as a physical element, not constructed of these inorganic materials, concrete, steel, and glass that we traditionally build from. This has kind of all these inherent qualities that through a living structure has these certain benefits to where the building could begin to start to heal itself, for example, rather than having to be maintained through this kind of weathering that you get.
Is that cement? Is that
this is just kind of a
stucco, cement.
Oh, just a minute here, my slides crashed.
That has to be maintained too.
It would be, yes. I mean, these were just artistic kind of renderings of a concept by this artificial intelligence software. So it's not built, that's correct.
I think it would give me a headache.
It's interesting how this is actually kind of rendered in this real slow kind of morphing. It's not like the art piece that was kind of this really dramatic splash. It's more kind of like a slow kind of movement that gives you the sensation, again, that the building is alive. It's not something that's inert, but maybe in its slowness enables you to not get so seasick with it.
And we would be inside, not as we are now outside.
Right.
So is that decomposing?
This idea is it's just morphing, not necessarily decomposing. But we're going to get in decomposition here in a few minutes with Neri's work. So she was looking for a way to create architecture, looking, again, much like we saw last week with Philippe Bloch's work in material science. He was more interested in studying the materials to build with. Neri's taking on the same kind of approach to her practice. She's looking very closely at the materials, trying to develop materials to build with. In Bloch's case, he was working with some of the brick and some of the more traditional materials from historically. She's trying to develop new materials, and these new materials she's trying to develop are these organic materials, organic-based materials, but then also, ultimately, we're going to see she's getting into materials that are actually living, biomaterials. She said, I noticed a significant dimensional mismatch or disconnect between what and the how of architecture. Especially during the early 90s, architects and designers were creating complex building and product forms using high-end tools and technologies for design generation and digital construction, generally without much understanding of material properties or concern for the environment. This has led to a significant rift between designers and builders. Nature, of course, doesn't have this problem. In nature, there is an intimate link between shape, structure, material, and growth. They are related. And so here she's calling out specifically in the early 90s, and if you recall back when we were looking at Zaha and Gary's work in the 90s, this was just right before Bilbao was created, for example. They were embracing the computer and applying it to their construction methods, techniques, the technology. She's doing a similar way, but in this case, rather than using the computer, well, she is using the computer, but in addition to that, she's also using the microscope. She formed this group at MIT, referred to as the Mediated Matter Group. And she went on to say that when I formed the Mediated Matter Group at MIT, I based it on a few core ideas borrowed from nature. The first was that shape is cheaper than material, and that the same should hold true for the built environment. The second was that in nature, you don't find assemblies of homogeneous materials. In nature, things are grown, not built. Making biological organisms and materials across all kingdoms of life, highly customized, responsive, and adaptive to their environment. And so she's specifically, these two points that she's making, the one is that shape is cheaper than material. Rather than trying to work through these expensive materials, she realizes that architecturally, you can study the shape of a building, and through that shape, you can control certain attributes as well as certain responses that the building's gonna have to the various elements like light and heat and temperature. And so this is specifically what she's studying in her material science, is looking at the shape, much like we saw last week with Bloch, that was also studying shape in the brick arch vault, as well as even Zaha and Gary. So it's not an uncommon theme, but she's recognizing that this is really one area that architecture can exploit. But then also the second point of being grown rather than built or assembled. She's trying to find a way to grow her buildings from a organic living material.
Well, would that be, that PNC building downtown that had a growing wall, which
right.
they took away for
right.
some reason, which I thought was beautiful.
Right.
Is that the idea?
It's similar, and that's kind of like an early stage or kind of like a very early approach. That's almost like a cladding that's applied to the surface, like almost a decoration. I mean, it's used for a decoration, but at the same time, it's used for other things like cutting down the heat load and absorbing the moisture, the rain, that kind of thing. But it's something that's applied to the building itself as a cladding, and she's trying to make the entire structure, the entire building, out of this material. So it's a good first step. She's trying to take it even further. So she founded this Media Matter Group in 2010. As I mentioned before, she got her doctorate from MIT in the same year. She had a diploma in architecture from the Architectural Association in London, the same school that Zaha studied and taught at. And then she also completed studies at the Facility of Architecture and Town Planning in the Israeli Institute of Technology. And even before that, she trained in medicine at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. So she comes from kind of a very diverse background, and she's taken this idea of material science, biology from her medical studies, and she's applying that as well. She's also amassing a pretty strong and talented team of individuals around her through this media group in various disciplines of science. She, to her credit, she's got over 150 scientific publications and inventions, including some patents. And her collection of work has been collected at MoMA, Smithsonian, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the Pompidou Center in Paris, Cooper Hewitt. And so, most significantly, even more than all of these kind of accolades, is the fact that, like, with each one of these projects we're going to be looking at here today, in order to study and develop these projects that she's working on, she had to also develop the technology in order to be able to create these products. And so every single one of her projects that she's worked on now for a couple decades has been at first step is kind of creating the technology to be able to develop it. And so that development of the technology is also part of the exploration and study. As she says, she's trying to do this study at the intersection between computational design on the computer, digital fabrication, which is much the same that we saw with Zaha with the CNC machines or these kind of additive manufacturing, this material science that we saw last week with Block, as well as even synthetic biology. So she has this idea of this, what she refers to as the Krebs cycle of creativity, where she, as an example, she gives these four disciplines, science, engineering, and design, and art, where science converts information into knowledge. Engineering then takes that knowledge and converts it into utility. And design takes that utility and converts it into behavior, or a change in behavior. And then art takes that change in behavior and turns it into a questioning of a way of being, or questioning of information. And then this information then gets cycled back into science again. And so it's this kind of circulation or tying together of these various elements that we have in various disciplines and kind of working together and tying them together, much the same way she's trying to bring architecture into the natural realm. 2020, just before the COVID lockdown, she had an opening of her work at the Museum of Modern Art that then was shut down because of the shutdown and went online. But this was an opportunity for her to kind of showcase all of these things that she'd been developing for the past couple years, which we're going to go through here kind of one by one. But this work she refers to as this material ecology, which considers all these things like the computation, the fabrication, the material science as inseparable from the dimensions of design as well as nature. As she says, products and buildings are biologically informed and digitally engineered by, with, and for nature. She also, interestingly enough, she's the first architect to implement a wet lab into her architectural practice. And so a wet lab is a laboratory that's licensed to work with biologic materials, including living tissue, human tissue. So she's got a BioLevel 2 wet lab in her practice, in her office. And as she points out, is that an architect without a wet lab doesn't have the ability to be able to study the materials to the level that she can, these organic materials. And so even if you're trying to get to an architecture that's organic, you can't get there unless you're you're studying the materials on an organic level. And so she's trying to push this idea of this wet lab into the architectural practice to be as commonplace as a computer or a drafting table. There's a few more images of the exhibition, which most of it was just taken in from the street looking through the window. And so just briefly, I'm going to go through a couple of her her projects she did for her thesis for her doctorate when she was at MIT. This was in 2007. This one was referred to as ray counting. And she was using the computer to model the process rather than modeling the product. And this is also something she applies to all of her work, where she's more interested in the process of how materials work, interreact, more so than the actual product of the end design. And so in this case, she uses the computer. She's taking light here in this case, in this ray counting that she refers to, and she's using the light to be through the computer to study through an algorithm on the computer to look at the intensity of the light as well as the directionality of it as it hits and bounces off these forms, and to create these, as you can see here with the light shading through here, these darker patches, lighter patches, as a result of the thickness of the material as the light is passing through it. And so she's dealing with this idea of density as well as transparency of how the light passes through, and this idea of using the form to kind of modulate these natural elements like light or heat as it passes through the material to see how the form, or in the case of architecture, can be used to then modulate these same kind of natural elements.
Is it fabric?
This is a print. This is a printed resin, so it's kind of an additive product. Again, this is like a study model. Most of her work we're going to see is on a smaller scale, with the idea that eventually it could be scaled up to become a larger architectural inhabitable form. Yeah, so again, so it's dealing with these transparencies, and also just dealing with trying to find a way to modulate light as an element that can be utilized to an end goal. This brings us to a second. She had three projects she did for her thesis. The second one here, called Cartesian wax. She was looking, or inspired by, the Cartesian wax theory by Descartes in the 1640s. Where he said that the essence of wax is what survives various changes in the wax's physical form. And so she was looking at a way to take this wax material through these molds. Here you can see this liquid wax here that's being poured in and amongst these this plastic molding material. And using the molds and recasting multiple times, and with each cast, the mold itself deforms slightly from the previous casting. And so this deformation enables her to create, or study, a way of manipulating the end result of the wax through this deformation. So if you recall back, when we were speaking with Gaudi's chair, and the deformation of the seat or the chair, or even Gary's chair for that matter, his cardboard chairs. She's looking in a similar way of trying to use the molding process to create these deformations and variations in the material across, again, various attributes. So she'll take, as you can see here, like with each one of these tiles that she's creating, she'll bring light or heat across this and use that movement of these various elements across it to affect the end result of the material. And then finally, her third piece, this was, if you think back to some of the the drawings that we saw last week with Block, when he was doing this modeling on creating these vaults with the computer, in much the same way that his program was breaking down these vaults into this kind of spider web of form. She's doing a similar thing here with her forms, where she's breaking the forms down, creating these voids, much that we saw Block doing in his work, to try to reduce the material, but also try to, in her case, as well as Block's case, identify these transferring of these stresses and loads through the material. And in her case, it's more so that she's also wanting to study to see how these various shapes and forms can then be manipulated by these elements like humidity and heat and light. So she's creating these, in this case, she's creating this model, the voids. She then passes the light through and then projects that down onto a surface. And then that surface then gets transferred to an actual physical surface, and to where that then becomes the model. And so she's doing it kind of in a physical way, much kind of the approach that Gaudi had with his models, that Block was also studying, this way of transferring three dimensions to two dimensions. But then even in addition to just transferring, you can see with the light, the shadow and the color, where she's trying to see how then the three-dimensional form can also be manipulated by these elements once they're projected onto the surface. So in 2021, a year after this exhibition, in November actually, in 19th, she debuted her manifesto, which is entitled Nature Times Humanity, where she pointed out that in 2020, we passed a point, a tipping point, or a critical juncture. She goes on to say, when this anthropomass, which is the mass produced by humans, had exceeded all of the living biomass on Earth. And so although human beings are part of the natural world, human activity and the goods that we design and build for our clothes to our cities have increasingly set us apart from nature, negatively impacting ourselves and our planet. Concrete, brick, metal, glass, will exceed the plants, animals, bacteria, and fungi. Current building technologies and material practices are main culprits, propelling us to an inevitable future where we are called upon to build shelter against ourselves. What are these values, principles, knowledge, skills that we must cultivate as we architect a future of synergy between the natural and the built environment? And so she's calling on the profession to kind of take a look at all of this stuff that we're building. And if you think back a couple weeks ago to Rem Koolhaas, his piece entitled Junk Space, where we're accumulating all of this built mass, and to the point where in 2020, Neary is pointing out that this mass has surpassed the biomass of organic material on Earth.
I hope they have elevators.
Right.
Doubtful. Well, where is that?
This is in Hong Kong. So also around the same time, she had her first child, Reka, and thesis or manifesto that she published, she made the point that by the time that her daughter reaches the age of 80 years old, we'll be well into the sixth mass extinction. As master builders and authors of this anthropomass, architects and gardeners of tomorrow will either make or break our bond with nature. So we need to like fuse hardware, software, and wetware, this idea of this bio lab that she's created, to create new types of structures that can respond, adapt, and evolve our way back home. And so with this manifesto, she points out five key areas of study that she's doing through this research. One is into fibers. Another one is into polymers. Third one is into pigments. The fourth one is into cellular solids, and then fifth is glass. And so we'll take a look at some of these examples, beginning with the fiber, this what she refers to as the silk pavilion. This was in 2013, where she was looking at this relationship between digital and biological construction, proposing methods that unite the biologically spun and the robotically woven, inspired by the silkworm's ability to generate three-dimensional cocoons out of a single silk thread. And so here she's looking under a microscope at a cocoon of silk, and just the construction of this, the way that it's constructed out of silk. Again, this idea of taking a single linear thread and spinning it into a three-dimensional object. In this case, she creates this dome, this tensile structure out of cables, and then she lays upon that with this robotic arm, she strings thread across it, between it, to create then kind of this structure or this netting for then the silkworms to be placed on top of, so that then they can spin their silk across it and then fill it in as a volume.
It's called sheep labor.
Right. 6,500 of these cheap labor silkworms, to the point where they spun, each one spins a filament of thread or silk about a kilometer long, but then when combined together is the length of the Silk Road. But here in particular, she's interested in studying how the silkworm goes about this spinning. And so she's studying the silkworm closely and seeing if she can try to manipulate their behavior, how they spin, to try to kind of coax them along to spinning in an advantageous way from an architectural perspective. But closer up to the structure, you can see this framework that the threads that are strung across it, that becomes kind of like this lattice that the silkworms are placed onto. Much the same strategy we saw with Gary and Zaha, where they had this kind of stepping of the larger superstructure and then the secondary structure that creates this kind of grid work to then apply the final finish cladding of this silk. She took the silkworms and she put little magnets on their heads, so that way she could then stick the silkworms inside a little box with the magnets, and she could then, with the magnet, she could trace their movement three-dimensionally within this box as they would then create this cocoon. And so then with that movement, she was able to take those movements, put it into the computer three-dimensionally in space, and she could then extract how this cocoon is made three-dimensionally from this linear thread. Yes. From this understanding, she was then able to, where they're pulling this thread across a flat two-dimensional surface, she went through applying various elements, like heat, for example. You can see here 20 degrees Celsius and 50 degrees Celsius, and the resulting patterns that you would get from the heat just being applied in the area of where these silkworms were operating would result in different shapes or different spinning from the heat or from these various elements that she's applying. She went through looking at electromagnetics and light as well. She found out that they choose to prefer to spin in the shade as opposed to bright light. And again, using these, once she sees how they adapt or how it modifies their behavior, that's a way or a control that she could then kind of guide them or coax them along towards a particular end. This was taken to what's referred to as the second iteration of this, the second silk pavilion, where she creates this armature, much similar to the dome. But in this case, she's making one that spins and rotates, so that way she can see how movement might affect the spinning of these silkworms. And in this case, she takes one that's static, one that's stepped where it shifts and sits and then shifts and sits, and the one that just continuously spins to see how that results in the resulting form of the silk being covering this face. Again, to see most of it's not only just the movement, but also just the orientation to the ground, or gravity being pulled down. One of the things that she discovers is that in the absence of like a vertical axis or like a tree branch where they normally would weave these cocoons, the silkworms don't produce this three-dimensional cocoon. They produce a flat surface. And so this is where she's able then get them to create this skin by the absence of this kind of vertical axis attachment point.
But there's not much difference between those three forms.
So the forms are the same. What she's doing differently is she's taking, she's studying the, I'll play here again. She's looking, this one's continuously rotating, one rotation per minute. This one sits and then it rotates slightly, sits and rotates. This one sits static completely.
What is the red?
The red is registering where they're building or where they're creating silk.
Is she trying to study like the distribution as to getting just a flat fabric with minimal overlaps or minimizing holes?
Yeah, that's a great point. Segue. Yes, so she's looking at the density of it, as well as also just the way that the silk is spun, as far as the orientation of the actual fabrics or the silk, but also this substrate, this netting here that they're weaving their silk onto, is a biodegradable netting. And so what she actually found was that as these silkworms are weaving along here, as they would urinate, the urination would dissolve the netting. And so then as this dissolved, it didn't have the netting to support the weaving. And so as a result, you would get these holes that would pop up from the actions and the activity behavior of these silkworms. And so that becomes part of, as a result of that, becomes part of the design that becomes organic. And this is also precisely to the point. Like, she's working with these as you said earlier, cheap labor, to where she's not in complete control of the end result of what this thing is going to create. It's part of it is in the control of where these silkworms decide to weave or urinate.
But how scalable is all?
Well, the scalable is the next step. Which we'll get into a little bit as we go along here.
I think I have one quick thing. The average 1,000 cocoons boiled equals one silk shirt. Mm. So think about sustainability.
Yeah, right. So along to that point, one of the silk industry is this very destructive process to create silk for consumer goods. And so she's trying to find a more sustainable, more natural way to produce this silk. And her point, in the silk industry, the traditional way it's done, you boil these cocoons, which kills the silkworms. She's able to keep these silkworms kind of going. Actually, she's creating this environment where it's like the ideal conditions as far as temperature and light and these types of things to kind of maximize their output. And so she's able to create silk then that is not so destructive to the worms themselves. But then to your point earlier, she's taking from these things that she's learning, temperature, light, various movements, orientations with gravity, she's able to then see how they result and be able to then slowly start to refine controlling those elements to get various different types of outputs.
Question?
Yes.
So
as an example, so she builds as a proof of concept, she builds this piece for MoMA that went into their collection that we'll see here. She builds this, again, this tensile structure that lays over this piece. and with the idea that the structure itself can be adjusted to create various forms that the silk is being grown onto. And then in addition to that, she's bringing these into the industry where they create silk for things like shirts, and she's trying to show them their method to create and grow silk in a more sustainable environmental way. But then also this proof of concept, this show in 2020 at MoMA, you can see an installation of this particular piece. And here it's just a proof of concept of a surface that could be scalable and enlarged as a surface organically as a material. At some point, she's trying to get to materials that can be building materials. She's very much interested in the structural strength of those materials. Part of that density of the material is also looking at how it structurally holds up. One of the things she found, as these holes are created, it distributes, because the netting creates this vacuum, it redistributes the tensile loading on that surface, much the same way that Gaudi's stereostatic model, looking at the weights and how each little movement or reduction readjusts to the entire kind of machine or calculated thing. So she's doing a similar thing here, but she's doing it with this very kind of removed process where there's this silkworm in between. She doesn't have complete control. She's working kind of in her mind with the silkworms on creating this end product. She did a similar thing where she started to look at bees. In this case, she brought the beehives inside a contained room with the idea of inside a contained room you can control the environment, you can control the lighting, the temperature, the humidity, to basically create this kind of ideal spring condition year round, as opposed to hives that are outdoors. And this idea of working with, again, the bees, much like she did with the silkworms, in this apiary, which was in 2016, was this project. But again, the room offered this precise control of light, humidity, and temperature to replicate the ideal living environment for these bees to survive, to produce this pollen and sugar. They took in the colonies and they provided them with this synthetic pollen and sugar water to see if this synthetic that they would add to them, if they would still produce these honeycombs. Which they did, and they were able to then realize that through this, they could then use this to have the bees kind of create this kind of synthetic structure out of this synthetic material that was added in.
And eventually, what she envisions is replacing cement and concrete.
That's right, exactly. Replacing these kind of inner materials that we build with today.
Stand up against weather?
Well, we're going to see that in the second half here today. We'll get to that. The idea is not to try to stand up against the weather, but actually try to work with the weather and allow the weather kind of to decompose and break it down naturally.
Just tell us this isn't real, please.
That this isn't real.
That comb, the bees aren't dead.
It's close up. The camera's close up to the hive here, so they look big relative to the people standing in the background. But no, they're regular size honeybees.
I think it's worth noting that she was dubbed as a sericulture. It's been criticized by animal welfare and animal rights activists. The process of harvesting silk from the cocoon kills the larva. But I just found it fascinating that there's a Siri culture.
Right. So she's working, again, she's working with these various elements, trying to, by putting these bees in these various conditions, giving them various elements to work with as far as kind of creating these honeycombs, adjusting these natural elements like heat, humidity, temperature, to affect the end result of what they build out. Again, with this idea that then once you understand the way that they create their forms and how these various elements affect the result of those forms, you have a method to be able to then try to create a form that's advantageous to inhabit. She was also playing around with magnetic fields. The geometry we're seeing here also, that they would create these combs within. Here you can see she introduced rotation like she did with the silkworms to see if, as they are constructing these combs, whether the fact that the orientation relative to the gravitational pull had any impact on that.
Well, that's clearer than the other with the silkworms, because that does look different. I mean, that's different.
Right. You can see a much more dramatic effect. Yeah, the bees are much busier.
Is that what?
They get paid more.
That's right. They've got a stronger union.
Is she considered an architect or a researcher?
It's a combination. So she's kind of trying to redefine the profession as far as, and that's to the point, like we saw with Block last week, is that there is this kind of segment within the profession that is interested in the building sciences and researching and developing the materials that go into construction. And so there, you know, that's a whole facet of it, in addition to just the construction end of it. And so we see, generally speaking, the industry's kind of moving in that direction more so because there is a need for this building science to kind of create, like in Nuri's case, these more advanced types of materials to deal with things like carbon and...
But if you never build a building, are you still an architect?
That's a good question. So she just... Well, as we'll see a little bit later on here, she opened an office. So she did all this, most of this study while she was at MIT within this media lab that she had created.
And they provided funding?
It's a combination. But she then went, a year and a half ago, she opened up an office in Manhattan into where she's now brought this lab to New York, and she's doing it in a private venture to where she's not only trying to scale, build these things that she's doing, these proofs of concepts, at a greater scale, but then also then take that scale to a point where she's actually going to build something. She hasn't got to the point where she's built something yet, but she's kind of moving in that direction.
Her husband is Bill Ackerman, a
That's right.
billionaire hedge fund guy.
Okay. That's right.
Okay. I have such an ignorant question. You have to excuse me.
That's all right.
So I'm looking at, say, one of these objects here. Now, these bees are growing something on a matrix.
That's right.
Okay. Is this what's left after the matrix is dissolved, or does that include the matrix and all kinds of...
It's a combination of that. So when she works on these studies, they're branching off in all kinds of directions. I mean, part of this also, as they're doing this, like we saw with the magnet with the silkworm, kind of charting the path in three dimensions. Once they kind of create these things that we saw here, she would then scan them digitally into the computer to where she could then manipulate them, as well as even print them out. As we're seeing here, into like a model form, and so that it becomes something that is replicable in kind of more additive manufacturing sense. She ultimately wants to get to the point where these things are actually going out and kind of like just growing or building these forms.
But I'm saying, you know, I'm looking at the structure here.
Right.
Does that include the matrix, or is this something that's made by 3D printing or whatever?
It would be both. Like in this case, it's the 3D printing, but then in here, it's the bees creating these combs on top of this structure, that matrix that she's providing, much like the silkworm, where she provides them a mesh to work from.
Her whole concept was based on sustainability.
That's right.
So why is she dealing with such teeny tiny producers in a silkworm and a bee,
right,
rather than working with organic plants that could be huge and create something, a sustainable structure that's, it's never going to be realistic to have enough bees to make a structure a human could live in.
Well, if you get enough bees, you can make something pretty big. But we'll get to the plants in the second half of the lecture. The plants we'll get to in the second half of the lecture. So she's getting to that point, but she's starting off with these bees and these silkworms. Again, if you have enough of them, they can do quite a bit. And also, nature operates on a very microscopic level, on a very small level. So, you know, by just the inherent properties of this this material that she's working with, it necessitates kind of like on this smaller scale.
Okay, so I don't know about bees, but I know a little bit about silk, and that is the silk is a protein.
Right.
All right. And certain amino acids in a certain order cause this great, great tensile strength.
That's right.
That silk has. And this can be duplicated in the lab.
Right.
It has been.
Right.
So I'm thinking that, you could create synthetically the gene for this, and then in a lab just let it go and perhaps scale that up.
That's right.
You know, so it gives you the material, but I don't know if you can do it on the matrix or not.
Right. Yeah, so after the break...
You don't necessarily need the silkworm.
That's right. And after the break, we'll see, as she's kind of moving along, she does take that step. And we'll see an example of that after the break, where she is then creating this synthetic material that's based on these organic materials that these organisms are creating. And she's in a lab setting then be able to work with the synthetic material. We'll see an example of that after the break, which, to that point, we'll take a break here for 5 minutes. Pick up just shortly after 2.
Who was Bill Ackerman? Oh, hedge fund. Of course I don't know. If he could afford to buy something.
Yes.
This is worth
it. Yeah, I'm going to do that when we pick up. Yeah.
That made it all very clear.
She's more of a scientist.
So I guess she's really creating stuff that's strong,
right?
But has lots of holes in it, so you don't need that much material.
That's right. Yeah, much like we saw with Block last week, you know, trying to reduce the material, the material needed. But she is absolutely interested in the strength, and we'll see a little bit more of that in the second half here.
Yeah, and I don't know about bees, but I have read about
silk.
Yeah.
Can you imagine presenting this to a client?
Right. Well, actually, interestingly enough,
they would go for that.
Interestingly enough, she points out. She says that she would like architects to think of nature as being their first client. And the client that actually pays the bills being their secondary. That's right, exactly.
Yeah, so proteins can be pretty tough.
Sugar substitutes. Why did you mention Bill Ackerman?
Because he's her husband. She's married to him.
How did you know that?
I see.
The Wall Street Journal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Her first husband was a composer.
She's a genius.
Yeah.
She really is.
Yeah,
and she's gorgeous too.
Absolutely gorgeous.
She's talented.
So how sustainable is building a hotel room in the middle of no place where people are going to have to drive back and forth?
Right.
This idea of building communities where you're close to your work and everything, you know, that you don't have to drive and, you know, yeah,
right.
Sort of sustainable. You know.
Right. No, that definitely makes more sense for sure.
Oh my gosh.
But good for her.
Yeah.
She could play the mascot.
Yeah. I mean, talk about
very talented.
Hitting the marriage jackpot.
So she's brilliant and she's not beautiful. Western McGovern. And she'd be hilarious.
Probably. In the early days before she was married, that was all.
Now it's.
She might be the only person worse than that.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have to grow a lot of mulberries to feed all of those.
That's true.
Matt, you know, Asian architects seem to be much more into working with nature than the American and European architects.
Right. Yeah, the Eastern philosophy definitely kind of aligns with it much more so.
Yeah.
So I'm going to pick back up here because we've got quite a bit of material. Before the break, you had the question that you were asking about, if you don't build a structure, are you an architect? A couple more questions I'll throw out there as a critique of Neri's work.
And I'm not being critical, I'm just...
Yeah, no, it's a valid question. There's a guy by the name of Frederick Kiesler, who mid-century created this thing called the Endless House, that was also in the collection of Museum of Modern Art's permanent collection. And Kiesler, despite the fact that he did everything he could to try to get a client, he couldn't get clients, and he couldn't build as much as he would have liked, in particular this endless house concept. But nevertheless, this concept was so infectious, it influenced quite a few architects of his time, including Mies and Korb. And so you have this house, or even like we looked at 2 weeks ago with Gary in the Lewis House. Here's a house that was never built for a client, but ended up, according to Gary's own words, being probably the most significant project he ever worked on, and because it fed into all these other projects subsequently. So, you know, in Kiesler's case, you know, he never really built anything, but is he still an architect, creating architecture that is on paper or in model form, not inhabited, but still is impacting and influencing these other architects that then create and a result to that. Zaha had that similar thing. Most of her early career was on paper because she couldn't get those first commissions. And she also attributes that time period as being her most productive time in her career as far as development And so NERI's kind of fallen in the same foots as far as this research kind of building up and trying to get to a point where she can then kind of implement this into a something. Because at the end of the day, you know, her goal is to not only create and build something, but then also have this as a proof of concept model that this can be done, and this is the direction that we need to go. But to ask a couple questions here before we get back into it, if grown organics, as she's proposing, have a lower carbon footprint than our traditionally mined materials like concrete and steel, should plants and animals and bacteria be enslaved to produce this material, organic material? Because this brings up a moral question as far as we talked about before, the cheap labor. And if organics can be made in a lab synthetically, yet still of a biological living material, is this better than actually taking a straight organic from a silkworm or a bee? And so this kind of blurs this line between living material that becomes a shelter, becomes this inhabitable shelter. Again, it's much what this course has been looking at. We started off, we were kind of blurring the line between a wall and a roof or a window. She's taken even further and kind of blurring the line of what the wall and the roof is made of in the material itself.
But I wouldn't use the word enslaved. I mean, that gives them human properties.
Well, enslave in the human sense, but at the same time, if you're taking these silkworms and you're depriving them of becoming butterflies or moths.
I see.
Okay. And so then, you know, but that nevertheless, you know, you're giving them, you know, these, like the bees in the container, you're giving them this living environment that is like this ideal, you know, year-round living environment. So, you know, but it's definitely a question that I think she's going to have to wrestle with at some point. And to your point, question beforehand, as far as you can create these organic materials synthetically in the lab, and is that a better way to do it? And at the same time, if you're creating it in a lab and it's synthetic and it's organic and it's living tissue, even though it's lab created, it's still a living, you know, these are questions that need to be wrestled with as far as if we are going down this path. So this brings us to a third project that is referred to as Glass One. She's looking at glass as a material, glass being a little bit less of this kind of moral dilemma. It's this silicone kind of considered inert, relatively speaking, to some of these other materials. But dates back to a long history, 4,500 years ago in Mesopotamia. And then carried out through glass blowing with the Romans, and then it's finally like the plate glass more recently in modern times. She had developed this process of 3D printing with glass, using glass as a medium for a 3D printer. And again, as I mentioned in the beginning, all these studies that she's doing, in order to kind of get there, she first has to develop the technology to do it. So she developed and created this 3D printer for glass, where it's able to pour molten glass through the nozzle like a 3D printer and create this kind of stream, which she then has patented. But one interesting point as we watch this clip here is that as it's pouring, here she had the nozzle up off the surface at a distance, and it caused it kind of like droop down in a little less controlled fashion to where then the threads, play this again here.
But doesn't glass have a much bigger carbon footprint?
It does. So rather than a traditional 3D kind of additive printing that we see here, where it's kind of stacked and controlled, here this looseness or kind of like this air condition, they coined the term this auto-coiling, where there was, again, this distance, and it allowed it to kind of droop down almost like a honey or a toothpaste. And this, by doing so, created this texture of this surface that had
the exterior curvature of the form had a different radius or a different shape than the interior curvature, and as a result of that difference, it creates, being a transparent material, it becomes in effect a lens. So with being a lens, you then have these concepts of magnification, intensification of the light that's passing through it. And so the material itself, she's able to then create these properties to where she can now start to, depending on how the shape is created or the lens is created, she can control the way that the light goes through, the way the light's concentrated, intensified. It becomes this method to where she can also then use it as it's passing through the material to control other properties of such as heat collection or energy for harvesting, for that matter. And so then she took these as, again, proof of concepts. She created these forms through her 3D printer, and you can see the light effects that as the light is projected through it, how she's able to get various outputs. And so it's through this kind of using this as a form or as a tool to create this modulation end result of the light property. And so then through that study of these forms and this process, she's able to then find ways to manipulate light and heat and energy through this technique of this printing that she's developed.
Is that more practical?
It doesn't have practical application immediately, but the idea is this experimentation to kind of get to that point.
That's quite elegant.
Right. That's right. Again, you can see, you know, the light effects that she's getting on the floor. Also, in this particular case, she's taking, you can see the pieces from this printer that she's stacking to create a column. She's moving the light vertically through the column up and down on a line here. And as it moves up and down, it changes the position on, as you can imagine, the light effect on the ground becomes this lens that affects the light around it. This brings us to this second project here in 2018. Agahuluka is the name of it, and it's this polymer base, chitinin and cellulose, that she's looking into and studying. She says that this project points to a future where we subvert the industrial cycle of overproduction and obsolescence through the use of abundant natural materials, an ability to temporarily divert materials from a healthy ecosystem, to integrate them into human designs, and to enable natural decomposition back into the environment. So she's looking at these biopolymers, composite materials, as an alternative to plastics. And where she's going to vary these mechanical and optical properties in order to, on a molecular scale, and using a robotic arm in the fabrication.
Context on impact real fast. United Nations Environmental Program, over 300 million tons of plastic are produced globally each year, and less than 10% of it is recycled.
Yeah.
Huge amounts in the ocean.
Yeah.
Huge amounts.
And there is no substitute for the plastic, really.
As of now.
With, exactly. Precisely to this point, she's trying to work towards developing these materials. In this case, she's working with cellulose, pectin, chitinin. Cellulose makes up more than half of the plant matter worldwide. Chitinin is this crustacean and in fungi, this material that she's extracting towards, again, very similarly with the robotic arm and this 3D kind of additive printing, creating this mesh and infill
could see a little bit of the process here with the printing here. You can see the nozzle coming down and extruding these materials. One material being used as a mesh or a lace or a structural formwork, and then the other as an infill between it. So it's a very similar process that we've been seeing along here. So these materials react to their environment over their lifespan, adapting their geometry and mechanical behavior in the fact that they're organic, as well as their color, in response to fluctuations in heat and humidity and sunlight. They're a time-based temporal behavior as a design feature to where it's able to sense the information of the user as well as adapt to changes in the environmental conditions. And so with that, she's looking at, once the material is made and installed, this evaporation that happens because it's this organic bio-based material, the evaporation causes the structure then to become stiffer, has a little bit stronger properties. She's looking at the tensile strengths.
It doesn't shatter.
And you can see also here, again, much like the previous glass, she's looking at the way that the light comes through it, becoming a way to modulate light and heat. She's starting to create these forms, three-dimensional forms to stand. In this case, she's creating this proof of concept of these 5 meter tall, what she refers to as pavilions. This pavilion here in particular is made of shrimp shells and fallen leaves.
What's its lifespan?
So, perfect segue. So she took this piece, went out to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, put an installation in where she kept her sensors on it once it was installed so that she could measure the changes to it over time to see what its lifespan would be. In addition to that, as it would break down, this breaking down or this decomposition would also be transferring calories from this decomposition. And so she actually measured the calories that it would release in this decomposition, which turned out to be in the realm of 40,000 calories. So it's a way to also possibly harvest that energy from this decomposition, again, as a way to explore other types of energy harvesting, but it's out in the open where it's being exposed to the elements, wind and humidity and temperature, precipitation. All of it's adding to this decomposition that then you see in the end structure itself. As she says, decay over disposal, a world without waste. So the products as replacement for plastics, and entire cities that can degrade in contrast to the Roman notion of monumentality where buildings survive forever. And so it's this idea of this life cycle of the material to where it can kind of return back naturally to the ground from where it came up in a way that also not only takes less energy to with traditional materials when you have to tear down and rebuild, but that energy can actually be harvested, so it actually produces a net positive. She says, how can we start thinking about design of buildings and products that are alive, are adapting, and that are responding to the environment and the human body? How can we incorporate biological materials? How can a building survey the immune system of its inhabitants and then respond to it? So she's trying to create what she refers to as these HLMs, or hybrid living materials, this class of materials that combine artificial and biological matter with a prescribed functionality. And this brings us to a 2019 project she titles Totems, where in her mind, she says that the architectural toolbox, not limited by the drafting board or computer, but is enabled with a wet lab. If an architect has access, we open the doors for not only constructing things out of already existing materials, but literally growing things. The ability to use living cells, this allows us to incorporate functionalities that were never available inside a product or a building. One example is this melanin that she's using here, which is this pigment that we find in our skin, incorporated inside glass, for example, in order to mediate between heat and light on the interior environment. So you literally build a first of its kind biological skin in an architectural facade. And so she's taken this melanin that naturally occurs, and she's using it as this kind of biomarker in evolution, to where not only controls life, but also creates this resistance in the skin, protecting us from ultraviolet radiation, for example. We can then create facades or envelopes to our buildings that then also protect the inhabitants from this radiation.
Is that produced in the lab, or do I have to donate?
So she started off with extracting this from like a cuttlefish, for example, but then she did develop it to the point where she was able to synthetically engineer it in the lab from like an E. coli. So this melanin can be synthesized through a reaction between enzymes from mushrooms, and then the protein building block. And the pigment can be extracted from, as she says, bird feathers and cuttlefish, amongst other sources, and purified and filtered into a series of steps. The genes of melanin production can also be engineered into bacterial species such as E. coli, and thereby controlled over space and time in response to changes in the environment. For instance, its colorization could deepen as the sun reaches its peak during the day, or providing protection from solar radiation. So with this series, she created these totems, these poles, where the interior of this created these cavities through a additive process with the computer, these kind of 3D printed biological forms that then would be infilled with this melanin to create this movement through the form, and also the changes in the density and the color over time from, as you can see here, introducing various types of compounds. This, as she points out, this enzyme is light sensitive, affecting the density and the color. Here's an example where she is implementing this into a proposal that she did for a competition, the Nelson Mandela Centennial Memorial, to where she proposed this glass structure. So thinking back here again to Johnson and Mises' glass house, she's creating this glass structure where the glass perimeter can then have this melanin placed in it, and then affected by the environment, the sunlight that's passing over it through the day, to where it creates this opportunity for it to have the UV protection during the day, as well as also enabling it to adjust in the evening once the sun sets, to be able to stargaze from inside the structure.
That's just one. one panel in a glass box?
That's right. Yeah. Was the proposal. This brings us to this, what she refers to in 2021, this concept called the digital construction platform. She takes a mechanical robotic arm that can move in the three dimensions, places it onto a truck so that it's mobile, to create this mobile platform that can be brought out and placed in place and act as a 3D printer. And in this case, she's using a foam that she's spraying out of the nozzle that can then create a structure much the same way that we saw her doing with at a smaller scale. Here she's trying to implement it on a larger scale. This, in this case, she's doing two layers to where then this could be then filled inside with another material such as concrete to create the structural strength, the foam becoming an insulating material. In this case, she's creating this dome structure.
But you could do that out of concrete instead of foam, right?
That's right. Yeah. The foam, again, as I mentioned, it adds the insulating factor to it in addition to just the concrete. This project actually was picked up by NASA with this idea of taking this mobile unit to places like the moon to be able to then create these structures remotely with this unit. This was actually, at the time that she made this, it was the largest mobile 3D printer in existence. There was some mention before about her office. This is the building she moved into in 2021, March of 2021, on Manhattan's West Side. It's an Art Deco building, an older building from the 20s. She's moving into the upper floor, as you can see here, creating this lab space. And in her words, she's with this office, she's trying to, again, demonstrate proof of concept to other architectural practices to radically change the design landscape from the ground up, to question the very nature of how we make things and how we can make them in different and better ways for us, for the planet, and for other species. That is why I'm forming this new company. And so we saw a couple weeks ago with Gary, with his method with applying the computer to architecture, where he upended kind of the entire profession and kind of dragged them along to his methods. And so she's trying to do a similar thing where she's trying to disrupt not only the architectural practice but also the construction building practice towards this idea of working with biomaterials. And that brings us to one last project here. This is referred to, she calls Manhattan, which is a project she's a study that she did in conjunction with Francis Ford Coppola for a forthcoming movie entitled Megalopolis. And this project is taking this long view of not only humans, but evolution and the planet in this longer kind of habitat loss. Or in her mind, this like species extinction. She's revisiting, as an example, Manhattan as this test case, Manhattan Island, as we see here from above, the grid that is opposed across the island, but then also going back to pre-1600s when it was an island that was more of a swamp of hills and occupied by the natives. At that time, point out, before it was the Europeans came over and started building it out to what we know of it today, it had over 55 different ecological communities in a territory of 20 square miles. Consisted of valleys and forests, fields, wetlands, sweat, salt marshes, and streams. So this film concept that she's creating this model for this film entitled Megalopolis, which I think is coming out the end of this year, maybe summer of next year. It's in post-production right now. But the premise is this architect and a scientist who seeks to rebuild New York City as a utopia with a magical material that's referred to as the Megalon. This Megalon magical material being one of these materials that we've been looking at in her work, this organic bio-based material. It's a, this, in the movie's case, it's this multi-scalar, genetically modulated physical intelligence with computational growth algorithms, and that can be applied across material, architectural, as well as urban scales. And so it's precisely kind of this vision that she's talking about with these materials that she's studying. This film is going to kind of depict how this is scaled to the point where it can become this inhabitable architecture. So starting, she breaks this down over time from the 2100 to 2200, 2300, 2400. Again, it's this long view arc where she's looking at Manhattan Island, in this case in 2100, looking out here a couple decades, is this first colony where she has these four essential seeds, which is shelter, nutrients, energy, and society. All of these kind of self-organize into a layered circular system of sunlight and airflow to shape its morphology. The water line defines its boundaries, being an island, and the hilly landscape kind of underlies its grid. And so through time, over the, again, this kind of 100-year increment, this thing kind of grows and expands and morphs. You can see here it grows in size and scale, then an inner piece also blooms, and then finally decays and drops away into its fourth stage. Here's an animation of kind of the way she sees this kind of biomaterial organically growing and expanding to kind of consume this portion of the island. So then in 2300, as the global temperatures and sea levels start to rise, the city undergoes a time-based kind of decomposition as the temperature as well as the water starts to decompose this organic substrate, much the same way that she's looking at in her these projects that we looked at, this decomposition that results from the heat that's and exposure to these elements.
So Manhattan will disappear?
It will not necessarily disappear, it will transform into this, crashed again. Just a minute.
So that's the idea, it'll go back to the Earth.
It'll return, and then finally in 2400, it evolves into this final state, or this next transition of...
Where do we go?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, is that the...
We're gone, right?
The
movie, or is this
is the movie concept. So I didn't mention a spoiler alert. I probably should have given that to you beforehand. So this as it evolves, you can see the skyline of Manhattan and beyond here, and this organic material is growing and transforming, taking shape. As it grows out and expands, the interior starts to decay away. That then ultimately gets replaced by kind of the secondary kind of bloom as the perimeter then starts to decay. This material, as you can see, it starts to kind of transform and become kind of the new skyscraper or skyline of the city from the old kind of older based material based inorganic material.
Sounds like a horror movie.
Right. The, as she says, by 2400, the urban cityscape of Manhattan persists as a memory, capturing in the hills and valleys of the landscape. The wetlands, the salt marshes, and the biodiversity of the ancient Manhattan are almost completely reborn in this new form. The old city becomes a fossil on top of which the new cycle of humanity is then built. So with that kind of doom and gloom, I'll end with one last quote here from Neri, where she says, "You don't need a scientific background to protect the environment. All you need is a question. It is not a science that will save us, it's humanity. It's kindness, it's curiosity, it's innocence, it's questioning the status quo, it's humility. And that is why I think art and science are intertwined." She gives an example. In 1902, you have Einstein and Picasso working on the same theme. Both were interested in the space-time continuum. One creates the general theory of relativity, the other creates cubism. But both have a sensitivity towards the questions of the time. And just connecting with that spirit can channel a great path.
Thank you.
Yep.
Where did she grow up?
Israel.